Welcome to the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor, Executive Director of Literary Arts. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers for more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. In this episode, we bring you Carlos Fuentes. It's a talk from a literary arts special event in 1990. Fuentes is a Mexican writer who wrote in just about every possible genre and was also an editor, publisher, diplomat, political activist, and public intellectual. His postmodern experimental novels ultimately earned him the Cervantes Prize, the most prestigious prize in the Spanish-speaking world. He belongs to a generation of writers that includes Gabriel Garcia Marquez, Mario Vargas Llosa, and Julio Cortazar, who together helped create El Boom, or the global surge of interest in Latin American writers in the 1960s and 70s. In his obituary, the New York Times described him as one of the most admired writers in the Spanish-speaking world. This talk, which took place in 1990, is eerily relevant today. It is political, to be sure, but the key to it, I think, has to do with a literary reference Fuentes makes near the end. He references Francis Fukuyama's essay, The End of History, which appeared in 1989, and was later expanded and published into a book that became an international bestseller. The essential argument of the essay is that, with the collapse of the Soviet Union and other authoritarian regimes, that Western-style liberal society would become global, and that political evolution would come to an end. In his talk, Fuentes rejects this idea, arguing that the world would fragment into multiple power bases and become increasingly complex to navigate. In other words, the opposite of Fukuyama's argument. Because Fuentes is a writer and a poet, his talk is filled with references to world literature and argues for the essential role art plays in creating empathy, humanizing our societies, and building communities. I find it interesting, all these years later, that it was the poet, not the political scientist, who was able to see the future. Here's Fuentes.
The world has moved so rapidly since last summer that one could almost speak of the symbolic 9-month gestation of not only a new century, the 21st, a third Christian millennium, and a new decade, the 90s, but that all of them have come together in such dazzling, unexpected, and simultaneous ways that it is as if instantly a brave new world had been born. We even blink and wonder, was there ever a 20th century? Or was it only a kind of unnatural prolongation of the 19th century? Its pent-up conflicts, its unresolved ideologies, and its promises of scientific and technological progress as well. But whatever else could be said about the 20th century, I think it opened up our eyes to a tremendous fact, which is in the center of our conscience, of our hearts, and that is the universalization of violence. 100 years ago, you could still think, or the West thought, that violence was reserved for the other, the alien, the dark races, and perhaps a few misguided anarchists. But these were Russians, or maybe only characters in Joseph Conrad novels. A new geography of terror, a new geography of terror from the trenches of World War I to Auschwitz, to the Gulag, to My Lai, soon proved that the West was just as good as exercising violence as Berber tribesmen or Mexican revolutionaries. The century of immense scientific and technological advance was not, in other words, an age of comparable political and moral progress. But if it made real both the material dreams and the intellectual warnings of the 19th century, it did not highlight the real common nourishment of humankind, which is its cultural heritage and continuity. That is why in the fantastic whirlwind of change that is taking place, I like to pause and recall a few words from Spain's greatest contemporary philosopher, José Ortega y Gasset, for whom political and economic facts could not be understood without a cultural basis. Life, Ortega y Gasset once wrote, is first of all a set of problems, to which men and women respond with a set of solutions called culture. The philosopher adds, I quote him, "Since many solutions are possible, it follows that there exist and have existed many cultures. What has never existed, says Ortega, is an absolute culture. That is, a culture responding successfully to every single challenge it meets." And I then add, "Since there is no absolute culture, there can be no absolute politics either. What there are many cultures, many truths, expressing themselves through many politics." My generation, a product of mid-century university education in Mexico, and of the critical face of the Mexican Revolution, identified itself with Ortega's words. But we were frustrated, deeply frustrated, by a feeling of being confined in an artificial world strictly divided between good and evil, us and them, the world of the Cold War. Two ideologies, two systems faced one another implacably, and it would seem then until the end of time. You had to choose, align yourself, and serve the ideology of one of the two sides, rhetorically, and quite literally, its interests. In this manner, many political and cultural possibilities were sacrificed. Movements for change and reform in one or the other spheres of influence were frustrated because if they happened in the North American sphere, they were disqualified as pro-communist, and if they happened in the Soviet sphere, they were condemned as pro-capitalist. Yet many of these movements simply originated in cultures that responded neither to the Soviet nor to the North American typifications. But that from Mexico to Argentina, from the Baltic to the Mediterranean, and from the Sahara Desert to the Yalu River, were the bearers of their own values, patiently woven on the loom of centuries. Change in Africa, Asia, Europe, and Latin America could only come about in relation to these traditions, renewing them, opposing them at times, but contributing in all cases to the common fabric of humankind. Today, we're witnessing a rapid change from the frozen world inherited from the Yalta agreements at the end of World War II to an extremely fluid situation. A bipolar structure has given way to a multipolar structure. We clearly see that the world has many centers, many faces, many solutions, and not just two. But to speak of solutions means to speak of problems. And the euphoria justifiably surrounding events such as the fall of the Berlin Wall and the possibility of building the common house of Europe. The peaceful popular uprisings against the sclerotic communist regimes in Central Europe, the unification of Germany and the affluence of Japan, the opening up of the Soviet Union and the almost universal practice of democracy in Latin America should not blind us to the accompanying problems that change always brings with it. The historian Arnold Toynbee once made a list of the foreign invasions suffered by Mother Russia and came to the conclusion that no other nation in the world had been assailed so many times by external aggression. But along with the fear of outside attack, Russia has been driven by the need to modernize, to come out of isolation and join the world. Both obsessions come together from Ivan to Catherine to Lenin in the drive to become a great world power. Russia has believed this pretension to be justified by her resources, her extension, her culture, even her spirituality, but mainly because that was the way to achieve the twin goals of her national existence, security and modernity. Unfortunately, both Russian obsessions found their political channel in the system that has always ruled that country, Caesaropapism. Whereas European democracy is the result of a protracted struggle between the two spheres, spiritual and temporal, and their eventual separation, the separation of church and state, Russian autocracy is the result of their union. Until 1917, the spiritual power was called the Orthodox Church, intimately linked with Tsarism. Since 1917, it was called Marxism-Leninism, inseparable from the Soviet state. The unity of these two factors won for the USSR the position of great power, indeed one of the two great powers in the post-war period. But the Cold War was premised on military prowess and competition between only two players. The post-war Cold War world is based on economic development, political competition, investment in education and research, and technological prowess. Its standard bearers are the two nations that won the Cold War, Germany and Japan. Military budgets over the past 40 years have been as skimpy as their investments in technology and education have been mighty. They have revealed the USSR as a hollow economic and political reality, inefficient in production, incapable of sacrificing life to death anymore without dying out herself, and with a population ever more educated but ever less satisfied by the political and economic poverty of the system. Mikhail Gorbachev, who is the product precisely of Soviet education, clearly saw that if ever Russia had been surrounded, it is now. Japan and China on the east, India south of the USSR, capable of exporting grain to feed her big communist neighbor. Afghanistan, the greatest mistake of Brezhnev's decadent presidency, proving that modern arms cannot do it all against a resolute nationalism. And also to the south, the powder keg of Shiite fundamentalism and in Iran, and the latent danger of a blow at the soft Muslim underbelly of the Soviet Union, a country with a minority of 30 million Mohammedans, 30% of the Soviet population. On the other side, the eastern half of Europe, anxious to get out of the Soviet fist and join its prosperous neighbors all the way from the Vistula to the Atlantic. And inside the Union itself, a quilt of nationalities fretting to obtain autonomy and even outright independence from Moscow. All of this adds up to an unprecedented danger for the USSR, both from without and from within, a danger far greater than the military challenge from the West, which could have still been met by continued sacrifice and the intimidating command economy, or even the conclusive danger of nuclear war, to be sure. But these are final events, and what is happening in the USSR is a continuous event, a continuous crisis in the hope of avoiding the final event from within that the cold warriors of the West could only dream about from without, the collapse of the Soviet Union by sheer implosion. Now, a politician can hide from a crisis such as this, deny it, even attempt to suppress it. Gorbachev has proved that he is a statesman because he faces it, grapples with it, makes mistakes, tries to correct them, and squarely looks a strategic reality in the eye. If the USSR is to survive into the 21st century, it must deal with its problems. And these problems can only be dealt with openly and without the burden of a costly empire outside or an inefficient empire inside. Certainly, it is extremely difficult to predict if Gorbachev will outlast the changes he has initiated or fall victimized to his own Frankenstein. And perhaps the gentle monsters of Glasnost and Perestroika can even revert to the old autocratic robot of the past. I doubt it. The cat is out of the bag, and he is roaming the alleys of instant communication, available information, and a visual vocabulary as well as a political grammar that transform walls into air and iron curtains into windows of irony. But the Soviet crisis does point to one of the great paradoxes of the movements we are now witnessing. The great trilogy of economic integration, technological progress, and instant communications can conceivably, lead us to a world order of shared plenty such as humankind has always dreamt of, conceivably. But hardly has this door been opened than the problems of culture have riotously stepped in to break up the celebration, informing us that the 21st century will also be the era of ethnic demands and revived nationalisms. How can you quicken the step towards global integration if you have Armenians and Azerbaijanis, Ukrainians and Lithuanians, Moldavians and Turkestanis yapping at your heels, denying the very principle of a worldwide interdependence of economic forces? I believe that this is the point at which political and cultural imagination must join hands and ask, can we reconcile global economic integration with the resurrection, anachronistic perhaps, but quite real, as we now see, of these nationalistic claims? Both reason and imagination should tell us that the solution, the name of that point upon which you can balance the demands of integration and those of nationalism, is called federalism. We shall witness, I hope, a revival, a re-evaluation of the federalist theme in politics as a compromise and a concertation between both forces. I am saying, and you as North Americans know it better than anyone else, nothing new. But this is such a self-evident truth that for that very reason it can get lost in the shuffle of rapid change. Yes, from the Baltic to the Black Sea, from the Danube in Europe to the Yalu in Asia, a great North American book, now more than 200 years old, should be distributed by the millions. It is a book written by three great North American statesmen, when this country had such a thing. Their names were Hamilton, Jay, and Madison. Their book was called The Federalist Papers, and out of it, 13 factious little colonies of the English New World became a great modern nation. Today, that great nation, the United States of America, and its frozen rival, the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, have lost their double hegemony and contemplate, perhaps with a sigh of relief, but mostly perhaps with perplexity, the appearance of a whole new constellation of power centers in the international firmament. Yet sometimes I fear that the USA might not follow the wise impulse to be both relieved and questioning of what is happening in the world, but might well fall into a doubly self-defeating attitude. Believing, on the one hand, that what has happened in the world is the result of policies and examples determined from Washington, a fruit of U.S. leadership over the past 40 years. This, in its turn, can lead to a disastrous belief that while the USSR has been forced to renounce its hegemony in the European sphere of influence, the USA is in no way obliged to do so in the Western Hemisphere and can act with impunity from Mexico on south. The alacrity with which most Latin American governments condemned the invasion of Panama last December was not due to any love for General Noriega, God knows, but expressed a deep concern that the Bush administration might confuse Gorbachev's retreat from Eastern Europe with a green light for the U.S. to reaffirm power in the Western Hemisphere. We were worried about the Panama invasion also because it showed a total disregard for a host of international treaties to which the United States is a part, along with Latin America, starting with the charters of the United Nations and the OAS, going right through the international conventions on asylum, diplomatic immunity, and prisoners of war, and even violating the Panama Canal treaties. The insensitivity of these actions was underscored by the decision to send, in what seemed a crude follow-up, a naval force off to the limits of Colombian territorial waters, and Vice President Quayle on a failed tour where he was refused reception in Mexico City, Caracas, and San Jose. The shift from a two-power to a multi-power relationship can create, I am aware of this, dangerous vacuums. The most visible one is being left by the rapidly fading power of the Soviet Union in Europe. Everything seems to indicate that this vacuum will be filled by Germany. But it is in everyone's interest that this Germany should be a European one, cooperating with the European community and with the world, and beholden by its treaty obligations with both. This means organizing competition, peaceful competition, organizing cooperation. As military rivalry becomes a thing of the past, and enormous resources become available for social, economic, and cultural development. But by its very nature, the political coexistence of several new centers of the world power and economic cooperation between them requires strict adherence to international law. Unhitched from the obsession of containing communism, since communism, for all practical effects, no longer exists, and even when it existed, it did not authorize violating the law on pragmatic grounds, the USA, along with the USSR and all other members of the new multipolar system, must respect international law as a condition for peaceful development based upon political respect towards the internal dynamics of each nation formerly within the Soviet or the North American spheres of influence. Without the law, the former president of Argentina, Raúl Alfonsín, recently said, we live in the jungle. And in the jungle, we, the Latin Americans, are certainly not the lions. But is the U.S. a lion anymore? When people in this country boast that what has happened worldwide is credible, basically or even only to the USA, it would seem that the lion, though a bit mangy, still enjoys a good roar from time to time. The United States, it is my perspective, has always had, I think, a soft spot for that form of roaring known as the Monroe Doctrine, for example. But for us, it is merely a unilateral, self-serving declaration of a North American president, long dead, which no Latin American government has ever recognized as legally binding. To the James Monroe Doctrine, we have tried to respond with the Marilyn Monroe Doctrine. Which is, go to bed with the perfume of your preference. The genial spokesman for the Soviet Foreign Ministry, Gennady Gerasimov, has even invented a Frank Sinatra Doctrine to describe Soviet policy towards Eastern Europe. Do it your way. I wonder if the U.S. is now going to invent the Red Skelton Doctrine. We did it. When the United States credits itself for everything that is changing in the world, this attitude not only insults the people from Prague to Managua who have made things move, it sours future relations, and it deceives the North American public, making them believe once more that they are deus ex machina in a universe where both interdependence and independence now deny any one nation the position of circus master. For example, the deeper changes in Nicaragua were not brought about by the Reagan administration, which opposed peaceful solutions and damned Congress for ending Contra aid. And it was not ended by the Contras themselves, who never won a battle anywhere and did not win the elections either. Rather, the changes in Nicaragua are unexplainable, first, without the diplomatic activity of the Latin America Contadora group in the early 80s, which blocked an outright invasion of Nicaragua and held fast to the principle of negotiations. Then, without the initiatives of President Oscar Arias of Costa Rica, who resisted intense pressure from Washington to transform his country into the southern front of the Contras, sacrificing Costa Rica's top investment against communism, which has always been its social policies in favor of a war economy. President Arias resisted, even in the face of economic threats, and launched his peace plan against the visible disgust of the administration in Washington. This is the policy that has triumphed today. By putting the destiny of Central America in the hands of Central Americans, where it belongs for the first time in their history. But yet a third, and I think the most important factor for changing Nicaragua, of course, was the Nicaraguan people themselves. The Sandinista revolution was driven by a desire to change the country's backward economic structures and to do so for the first time and without any obedience to any kind of orders from Washington. This is explainable in a country which had been invaded and occupied several times by the U.S. since 1912 and which had never been able to act independently of Washington since that date. But by doing this, of course, the Sandinistas risked war and got it by proxy. They certainly acted harshly at times, and these were war times. Losing 30,000 people in Nicaragua, the number of dead in the last 10 years, is like losing 3 million people in the United States. It also unleashed the revolution through education, a sense of self-respect, a national consciousness, and growing cultural awareness, as well as through many high-handed acts, economic failures, and political activism. It unleashed the forces of a dormant civil society in Nicaragua. The civil society organized itself into a broad spectrum of 15 political opposition parties, ranging from conservatives to communists. The government prepared the elections, drew up the laws, the lists, and the electoral census that the U.S.-backed Somoza family never had a need to do, since Washington never demanded democracy of an obedient dictator in Central America. Daniel Ortega asked for close international vigilance over the election, got it, lost the election, and kept his part of the bargain: hold free elections and hand power over to the winner, Violeta Chamorro. The real winner, I think, nevertheless, are the people of Nicaragua, who now await that the other side also keep its part of the bargain, which is the dismantling of the Contra Army. I give but one example of the Red Skelton syndrome. For it would be ironic indeed to say today, we beat communism, only to ask tomorrow, who beat the U.S. free market economy, democracy? During his recent trip to Mexico, Pope John Paul II warned an assembly of Mexican businessmen not to celebrate the defeat of communism as simply a triumph of capitalism. He recalled what we all know in Latin America. Capitalism, after 170 years of independence, has been unable to guide the majority of our people out of dire poverty. The same, of course, is true of our experiments in Latin American socialism for other reasons. But the danger for the United States is that, having lost its traditional enemy, the evil empire of communism, it should anxiously start seeking a new villain, a reliable villain abroad. This, I feel, is an almost permanent need in this country. Whatever the sources of the need, they are morally Manichaean and thus perfectly suited for cowboy films. And Cold War politics both require that black hats be distinguished from white hats and bad guys from good guys instantly and graphically. It suffices to watch Hollywood films from the earliest years. The parade of foreign enemies is impressive, from Mexican bandits to Prussian junkers to Chinese mandarins to Nazi, Japanese, or Soviet thugs. The most telling and acid commentary produced by Gorbachev on his U.S. tour was the following: forgive me, he said, for having deprived you of an enemy. Who will now take up the vacant post of recognizable villain? Could it be powerful Japan on the east, with her regressive commercial competition, her $78 billion trade surplus, her preeminent position in high technology, her incomparable capacity for transforming this technology into productivity, and the extremely strong and intelligent bureaucratic elite leading and shaping the whole process? Or could it be weak Mexico to the south, with an expanding population of 88 million, half of them under 15 years of age, a workforce growing by 1 million job demands a year, and responding to many of these demands abroad through migrant labor? Yet a Mexico at the same time going through a tremendous process of political and economic modernization while trying to maintain its cultural profile? I suggest, as humbly as I can, a very simple alternative to this dangerous facility of fixing your energies on a foreign enemy: Fix them on your internal enemies. They are abundant. A host of problems that have been postponed by the perceived dangers of the Cold War now make their appearance at noon. The federal deficit, the deteriorating infrastructure, the problems of the environment, opportunities for the poor and the minorities, the homeless, the inferior quality of education, drugs, the excessive foreign debt, excessive dependency on foreign investments, loss of assets abroad. All of these are challenges to the U.S., far more important, I think, than European integration or Japanese competition. For the United States finally benefits from having affluent partners who can share responsibilities and even preempt them. I think it is going to be basically Western Europe, principally Germany, who are going to equip and invest in Central Europe and the USSR far more than USA. The presence of Europe and Japan as responsibility sharers points towards a new world order of cooperation, as I said a moment ago, not of intervention. But the USA will not be able to cooperate anywhere if it does not defeat its internal villains, from deficits to drugs to deprivation. But doing so requires overcoming political fears and conventional wisdom. It requires a political debate beyond TV sound bites. The United States obviously needs strong political leadership for conversion from defense to social needs, for retraining workers, for going from almost mystical lip reading on taxes I don't want to get into your internal politics. I'm sorry. But what I mean to ask is, the questions I'm asking really, to you, to an American audience, but does not this in its turn require political renovation, political will, political goals that can only be set ideally by a multi-party system or minimally by a functioning two-party system? A Western European can choose between 46 political formations for the European Parliament. Sometimes from abroad, we perceive a US citizen most of the time as having to choose between Tweedledum and Tweedledee. A Western European within each nation has political options ranging from the extreme right to the extreme left. Does the USA lack a true opposition party in the European sense? A party offering real alternatives, strongly held opinions, such as are needed to face the problems now rising to the top of the list, to the top of the agenda. Without this will to politics, the US might well fall back among nations rapidly moving towards a new political consciousness. And this is that, even if the Cold War is over and regimes founded on the philosophy of Marxism have crumbled, this in no way means that the traditional distinctions between left and right have disappeared in favor of some kind of universal conservative consensus. Far from it. The distinctions now become sharper than ever because they are no longer shackled to empty ideologies, but to the very real and concrete problems that have attained priority as the arms race and the rhetoric of the Cold War fade away. What I mean is that the appearance of a multipolar world and the end of the double hegemony of the USA and the USSR does not mean that we have landed in political Arcadia, but that the zones of internal conflict disguised by the Cold War now rise to the surface. Women's rights, defense of the environment, income distribution, the homeless, drugs, the aged, the defense of the quality and freedom of the imagination against puritanistic onslaught, the strength and extension of the social safety net, and finally, the defense of the migrant laborers, their rights in the working place, their human dignity, the respect they deserve for breaking through the circle of poverty and fatalism in their countries of origin and answering the demands that otherwise would go unfulfilled in the developed economies that they so importantly contribute to. As the Cold War fades, another conflict rises in the slums, the factories, and the frontiers of the West, the appearance of the other. The migrant worker, disqualified at times as the new barbarian, hunted down at borders, denied access to courts and legal protection, blackmailed into accepting lower wages, expelled from Germany because the country now has cheap Eastern laborers and Turks can go back home, denied the right to send his children to school in French communities, terrified by the North African presence, murdered in the streets of Naples by the Camorra, bitten up by skinheads in newly liberated Prague. The statute of the migrant laborer thus becomes an urgent, central, and international issue of the post-Cold War period. Urgent, central, and international because it embodies all that we should have learned by now. The problem that is rushing forth to meet and embrace us is that of the other, learning to live in our new multipolar world with he or she who is not like you and me, but who constitute us by their presence as much as we constitute them by ours. The challenge is here with us, and it puts tremendous pressures and tremendous responsibilities upon all our shoulders. It means fighting xenophobia and racial prejudice, cultural ignorance, and both physical and psychological repugnancy. It means demanding the same from the other, of course, a respect for myself and for my own context, but always admitting that both the context of the other and my own can change positively through interaction and understanding rather than freezing in much mutual suspicion or even worse, in reciprocal violence. The breakdown of the bipolar structure in world affairs signifies the appearance of all men and women, not only Soviets and North Americans, communists or capitalists, as bearers of the destiny of humankind. For what the post-Cold War world offers us is nothing less than the chance of joining the world, all of us, including you, the North Americans. Sometimes from abroad, you seem to us to be overly narcissistic, let me say it. Interested only in yourselves and interested in the world only insofar as the world is interested in you. What do they think about us? Yet, with few exceptions, your media gives little space to the news of the world. Yet you are, like all of us in the Americas, a melting pot society. That is, a creation of the other. And melting pots are now either unmelting or brimming over, for the city of the 21st century is demanding that we not only assimilate the foreign, but that finally we accept its continued cultural personality. The question of the migrant worker thus brings together most of the new realities of the post-Cold War period we are now living, giving them focus and human concreteness. It dissipates unfounded fears and challenges prejudices, forcing us to see the reality of a worldwide process, founded not only on ideology or no longer on ideology, but on economic laws of offer and demand, testing the validity of much-touted market prescriptions, but also transcending them, first as a social event, embracing whole families, individuals, and communities in several nations, and second as a cultural event seeking its proper place in global integration and asking whether global diversity can coexist with economic equity. And finally, it is an international event, often masked as purely internal, but which will demand more and more international solidarity and international legality to protect the workers' rights. So in our new post-Cold War world, postponed issues march urgently forward. Nations and events are more interdependent than ever. Nothing can truly be isolated from what is happening elsewhere. The cultural component makes startling new demands on our imagination. History is far from over. History is not over. And one of its protagonists is the other, he or she, that in the simplicity of the Cold War we could dismiss simply as the enemy. Now, from Russia to Japan to North Africa to Latin America, the other is with us. The other has rushed into our time and space, just as the West, with its own values, has been doing with the rest of the world for at least 500 years. Let me then repeat my reflections this afternoon during the commencement exercises at Pacific University. We live in time. Time is history, and in history we are never alone. There is no history without the other. And although Jean-Paul Sartre once said that hell is other people, it is also true that there is no other paradise available than the one we were able to construct with our fellow men and women. Recognition of self is an extremely valuable fact of life. The two Americas, Anglo and Indo-Afro-Iberian, have spent a great deal of their existence since the 16th century in a search for identity, cultural, political, personal. But recognition of self soon meets a reality both harsh and delightful. We are not alone. The other is waiting for us, waiting to compliment us at times, deny us at others, challenging us always. But he or she will be inevitable presences in our lives if our lives are to be worthy of that name. We cannot hide for long from the other. Isolation, a saintly virtue, can be a sin resembling death in a world that claims our attention in order to go on being. The world needs our common effort, our solidarity, our capacity for constantly defining the balance between our individual needs and those of our fellows, our brothers and sisters, our parents, our neighbors, our lovers, men, women, and children. We look at others, and we're gratified when we see ourselves in them. But sometimes we're frightened, suspicious, even angry when we do not, when the face of the other is not a mirror image of our own. History is strewn with broken mirrors, the faces of the other, the Greek or the barbarian, the Protestant or the Catholic, the communist or the capitalist, the Jew or the Palestinian, the Indian, the black, filling the graveyards of time with the faces of those who do not resemble you or me. Yet behind the need to recognize the other lies the necessity to recognize and understand ourselves. Our need for the other is not disinterested. It should not be disinterested. We need the other to complete ourselves. No one can see a full reality by him or herself without the aid of others. This is the very principle of modern art and literature or in science. It is the essence of the works of Picasso or James Joyce or Einstein. If I refuse the other who is distant from me, invisible to me, different from me, or far in advance of me, I am refusing my own completeness. We are unique only because there are others, different from you and me, occupying another time in the world. And so we understand the relativity of the world, but also its incompleteness. The world is constantly becoming. We are becoming constantly. We are constantly beginning, yet carrying with us our past, the cultural baggage of our own making. Ladies and gentlemen, in the 15th century, Renaissance Europe, having discovered the Americas, thought that it had completed the world. But the new world, our world, is only new because it is incomplete, forever waiting to be fully imagined by its men and women. Remember, we are all immigrants in this continent. The first settlers from Asia overbearing, the Spanish and Portuguese explorers, the undocumented pilgrims who landed on Plymouth Rock, down to the last migrant worker who crossed from Juarez to El Paso last night. All immigrants, all bearers of the multiple strains that make up the Americas, what we are, transforming us into the continent of coexistence and diversity, a promised land for the 21st century, only in the measure in which we can live up to our polycultural and multiracial promise. It is here in the Americas that we must prove that the freedoms we have all recently witnessed and gained in the 90s for the 21st century are concrete. These are the freedoms of the multiracial, multicultural city, which is the inevitable product of instant communications, economic integration, cultural variety, and the challenge of the other, the challenge to our prejudices, our sense of our own limits, our capacity to give and receive, our intelligence in understanding the foreign and being understood by it. That is, the migrant worker offers us the chance of joining the world and enhancing our humanity. Let us embrace that opportunity. Thank you very much. All right, first of all, your question on FTA, the free trade agreement. Perhaps you know that this has become a principal debate, a principal issue of political debate in Mexico. The government has more or less announced its intention of seeking some form of integration with the United States and Canada. Several things are moving, I think, the present government of Carlos Salinas de Gortari towards this decision. First is the fact that the world is rapidly organizing into economic blocks, notably the Pacific Rim and the European Community, and the United States, which remains the largest market in the world. And I would think that our government is quite anxious not to be left out of any or all of these blocks, and that its most immediate possibility is joining, of course, because of the common border, because of the de facto integration that is happening every single day of the year through the porosity and the openness of the border with the North American common market. My own position is that the integration is happening whether we like it or not. Why formalize it? Why formalize it? Why be hitched to formally hitched to a situation from which we could not withdraw easily in case one or two or many foreseeable calamities hit this market, the market of the USA, because of the problems we are dealing with here, because of reading lips and the double deficit and the foreign debt and the social problems that this country has on top of our own problems, which is your second question, which I will try to address in a moment. So my position is that at least what we should have is an open debate in Mexico. It would be an extraordinary opportunity for us if in the Congress, the newspapers, the universities, in every possible way, we discuss the merits and demerits of joining this common market. And whether, furthermore, it would mean in any way renouncing the possibility of finding other economic and political supports in Europe and in the Pacific Rim. I think the government in no moment has abandoned the possibility of these two latter supports. The president, Salinas de Gortari, is now traveling to Japan, Singapore, and Australia at the beginning of June. I think he had a very positive meeting with Chancellor Kohl in Davos in the month of February, in which the chancellor was extremely open and extremely positive about singling Mexico out as the possibility of cooperation with Latin America. In the case of Japan, as you know, the investment of Japan in Mexico has multiplied by 30 since 1960. We find the Japanese in many of the industrial ports of Mexico investing in tourism, investing in the inbound factories of the frontier, which are mostly Japanese, neither American nor Mexican, by the way. And so this broad spectrum is there. This is being, of course, clouded over. This preoccupation is being clouded over and fueled as well by the fact that events in the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe have made many people fear that now investment is going to rush over there. And in fact, some Mexican economists have told me, say, if we had 10 opportunities, 10 offers of investment from Europe, the United States, and Japan a year ago, Today, they're reduced to 3. Out of 10, there are only 3 left because everybody wants to invest in the equipment, in the creation of basic consumer industries, in the whole panoply of opportunities opened up by the broken down economies of Eastern Europe. So we have all these problems. And I think that when all is said and done, our president is acting quite cannily, because he is saying, yes, let's go forward towards integration, at least let's have a national debate on it, and I will start by lowering tariff barriers with the United States unilaterally, which he has done for a number of Mexican products. Then he folds his hands and says, and when are the Americans going to lower their tariff barriers in reciprocity? That doesn't happen. Or he says, yes, let us integrate, including the labor market. And that is when many North American voices says, oh, no North American common market if it means integrating the labor force. That, no. So we might, I think, reach a reality which is neither that of a full formal integration or abstention from the reality of the market, but really, in a way, playing it by ear and saying, well, we want this. Why don't you reciprocate? Why don't you reciprocate? Finally, the two economies are interdependent, and it is to everyone's advantage, but basically to the migrant worker, that the two economies function as well as possible. Because if the United States has an economy that is more or less expansive, and Mexico has political stability and the time to solve many of its economic problems, then you can be sure that the laws, IRCA, the Simpson-Rodino law, will not be applied in all its rigors, and the border patrols will become, as far as they can, quiescent. Whereas if there is an economic problem in this country, producing instability and joblessness and unemployment, then immediately the law is applied in its full rigor, the border patrols come into full action, and we get the worst of all possible worlds with an effect in Mexico that means strikes in Mexico, manifestations in Mexico, and outright invasion of the border. So we're both interested in having economies that are stable and that are expansive and that are solving their problems. One of the problems of these economies is drugs. A general problem, an international problem, that has no easy solution, I'm afraid. Has no easy solution. There are countries that supply and countries that demand. The principal demanding country is the United States. We are supplying countries or countries in transit. And we're getting a bit tired of having the accusatory finger always pointed at the supplying countries while so little is done about what could be done in the demanding countries, right here, right here. I was shocked by the news I read this morning, and which you have brought home to me very eloquently tonight, sir. And yet I have to think that sometimes the workers, not only the migrant workers, but the agricultural workers in my own country and in Bolivia, in Peru, who make money out of growing coca and exporting it, and using all the medium, and even as I see now, and it hurts me, believe me, it hurts me very much, knowing that our own workers are involved in this traffic, yet we can not only treat this as a criminal problem, but we must offer those agricultural workers, those agricultural laborers, an alternative to planting coca. We must have a form of international cooperation which says leave the cultivation of coca, but here is something else that you can do. The great success of Alberto Fujimori, the Peruvian-Japanese candidate to the presidency in Peru, is precisely that he has said this: we cannot eradicate the drug problem unless the peasant who is growing coca in our countries has an alternate crop. And this, I must say, to a country whose second cash crop, the United States, is marijuana. The United States is a great exporter of marijuana. A lot of people make money of it, and very little is done to stop it. So again, we're here in a problem that requires international cooperation, realization of the cultural aspects of the problem and of the economic aspects as well, which is giving our peasants an alternative and doing a lot that is not done in this country to stop demand. That would be my response to your question. Thank you.
That was Carlos Fuentes speaking in Portland in 1990. This has been Literary Arts, The Archive Project. It's a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers for more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Join us next time for The Archive Project, a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting. To hear more from The Archive Project, subscribe on iTunes. And to help make this podcast and all our programming possible, give today at literary-arts.org/donate. Our show is produced by Crystal Liguori for radio and podcast with production help from Paige O'Rourke. Special thanks to the Literary Arts staff, board, and community. This show would not be possible without you. Thanks also to the band Emancipator for our theme music, and thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Andrew Proctor, and this has been another edition of the Archive Project from Literary Arts. Join us next time and find your story here.